Good afternoon. My name is Celso Ramos. I'm from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. I am also vice chair of IAPAC's Board of Trustees. I would begin by thanking the organizers very much for my invitation here and saying that though it has become somewhat hazardous for Brazilian nationals to come to the UK or to live here, I have been unscathed so far. I believe my light kin may have helped me at that. We'll have this session with a presentation by Dr. Ruben Granier from the WHO. And after that, we'll have a discussion with the distinguished panelists. After that, if we still have time, then we'll have questions and comments from the audience. Dr. Granier's presentation will be at IAPAC's internet link. And although some of the other presenters or discussants have given us their PowerPoint slides, they will not be presented here, but will be available online. Dr. Granier, please.
So great, thank you. I really wanted to thank the organizers, IPAC, for having me here to present on behalf of UNAIDS. And also such a distinguished panel. Any one of them probably could get up and give this talk, and I'm looking forward to hearing their remarks. So let's see, let's get this situated here. So what I'm going to do very briefly here is I'm going to talk about HIV modeling and policy, and mostly about the modeling and twins separated at birth. You'll see what that means later. HIV modeling and financing the response, strategy, the OODA loop, and the dreaded retrospectoscope. Now, if anybody knows what the OODA loop is and the retrospectoscope, the dreaded retrospectoscope, please don't tell your neighbor. That'll come later as well. Now, as many of you know, predicting the future is a lot easier than we think. And you have the Ouija board that can help you there. In the middle, you have a computer. You have the Mayan calendar prophecies. But discussing modeling and economics and the end of AIDS in this short amount of time is going to be quite a challenge. And I'll do my best. And there's two reasons why that's going to be tough. And one of them is basically that I'm not a modeler, and I want to be really clear about that. I don't do the mathematics behind the modeling. And I'm, as Jim Kahn and others on the panel will tell you, I'm not an economist either. They'll tell you that later. Now, modeling is very important. We use it in everyday life. I had about 13 slides on different models that we're using, but I picked this one because I think it was probably the most important. These are the global warming projections. And this slide gives us a number of options that we're all considering now. And it gives us a number of policy options. I wanted to turn to HIV modeling. And you can see this is the work from Anderson and May in 1988. Now, this is very soon after the discovery of the virus. And this is the seminal paper in the field, and starts describing the different parameters that are used in HIV transmission. So modelers are actually there very, very early, starting to think about what it would take to address the epidemic. And here's another paper, and I'm going to go fairly quickly through these papers. It's not really about data. It's kind of just about the progression of modeling. Here's another paper from Sally Blower, who many of you know, talking about San Francisco, my hometown. And she looked at modeling the HIV epidemic there, and there was great concerns about rise of resistance and about risk disinhibition. And so that's part of that paper, but it's very early in year 2000. And this is some work by Bertrand Aubert and Brian Williams, who I've done some work with as well. And one of the early papers that looked at viral load linked with treatment in a township in South Africa, and this is in 2003. So you can see that the modeling HIV epidemic had led people to actually start to consider, well, you know, what would happen if we started to treat people? And interestingly enough, in this paper, Brian Williams, they put forward that if we didn't have to go by the WHO guidelines, but we could go by the DHHS guidelines, maybe we would be able to prevent more transmission, which is an argument that we're actually that's very relevant for today. And here's Montaner's paper. Well, Wood and Montaner in Lancet in 2000, And then in the 2006 paper, which I think really is the clarion call that most of us read and started us thinking about this treatment as prevention issue in a major way, in a serious way. Now, this figure is from the paper that we put out in Lancet in, I think it was 2008. And the reason I'm showing this is that people probably have seen that. We talked about a few things that were important. One was that the possibility of elimination. That hadn't been done before. That caused huge consternation, I would imagine, among many of you in the crowd. Caused consternation, but we felt it was important. And the other aspect of this slide, which I think is important, is the idea that if you look at that red figure there, that's actually people that will be moving on to ART. So we are not talking about people living with HIV just disappearing. We're talking about actually all of them will eventually need to be on ART at one point or another. And then you see the decrease in incidence and these sorts of things that we were looking for. Now, reviewers asked us to do some, and I want to get into the economics here, right? Reviewers asked us to look at the funding on this for this paper, and we did a very, very crude, and I'm sure these folks will tell you, we did a very, very crude analysis there. But the two important take-home messages from this figure is that basically we thought for South Africa that we were within the funding envelope, which I think is a similar discussion as we're going to be having now. And also we thought that there might be cost savings, and I think that those ideas may hold to be true, still hold to be true. Now, HECT came through in 2010 and started looking at global resources. And at this point, that's when, I believe that's when treatment, the prevention impact of treatment started to be seen more commonly in these large-scale modeling efforts about finances. So that was an important breakthrough. And I think it marks a transition between what I call doomsday economics, where you basically say, oh, we have to treat more people, it's going to cost us quite a huge amount of money, to, oh, we have to treat a lot more people, but we're going to get a prevention benefit. Prevention in terms of illness, death, and transmission. So then we struggled. Jim Kahn actually led the modeling on this. Jim Kahn and Brian and Rod Bennett. We struggled for I don't know how long it took us. I hate to think, but anyway, a long time. And put this paper in literature, which actually talked about different scenarios in terms of when you would start ART and the potential for different cost saving scenarios as well, or how much money you would save by starting earlier. And we think that was an important piece of addition to the literature. Now, let me go back. This is the thing about the twins separated at birth. Let's go back to what's going on with policy. So at about this point in time, we're in 2010, you can see this is a little bit of a complicated graphic, but basically it's time moving across, and then the countries below are actually at WHO policy at that time or behind it, and the countries above are a little bit ahead of WHO guidelines. And no, I don't mean to be derogatory when I say that. It's just pegged to where WHO was. And you can see in 2010, most of the countries were actually at less than 350 or behind. So actually the modeling on some level was ahead of policy at this point in time, thereby going against the argument that modeling was actually driving the policy. In this situation, the 2010 guidelines came out and actually probably didn't take our modeling that much into consideration, or the modeling to date. Now, this led to the investment framework. This was a work done by Bernard Shortlander and many people, probably many in this room. And this actually was the kind of global second-generation economics, as I call it, and this looked at a less than 350 scenario, but definitely considered the impact of treatment and also a number of other prevention interventions. And then now and then just kind of to quickly get us to kind of where we are modern day, and you have Eaton's work, which brought together all of the modelers. I think there was a feeling that there were too many renegade modelers out there, and so it would be good to have them all in the same room and kind of talking about what the questions are and trying to get the parameters right. This was an historic paper for us because for years we had been criticized for being too optimistic and not using the right parameters, but it turns out that our paper is right in the middle, but it wasn't the most radical one, which made us happy, kind of. Now I wanted to switch gears just slightly and just focus on what I call third generation economics. And this, and Harsha may speak to this, but it's actually the look. The look now, instead of now looking at the treatment as prevention impact kind of globally, this is actually looking at what the impact is on the patient, what it is on the community. And here it shows that basically if you start earlier, people are able to work more. And I think you're going to see a lot more work in this area. And this is a very important perspective for ministers of finance and people like that. So next question, I'll shift gears a little bit from the HIV modeling and kind of go towards how do we spend the money? And I thought at this point in the talk, you probably need a few of these sorts of visual images. That's the Swiss Army down there, by the way. I'm sure you're focusing on that. Now, let's talk about PEPFAR. So all of this modeling, and arguably I picked my favorite papers, but all this modeling's kind of come together, and actually PEPFAR uses data, et cetera, to do their own modeling for their blueprint. And I'm going to very briefly just discuss it. They talk talk about the interventions that they favor, that they're going to invest in, and they include treatment. They talk about the tipping point, which is in incidence and treatment. And then you can see to the right, they look what would it be like for a less than 500 scenario for, I think that's Uganda. So this is well before the WHO guidelines. This came out a while ago. And then they also show in the center panel there that actually treatment costs go down as their treatment, the number of people that they cover go up, the treatment costs are going down. And I think we should watch that space as well. And then they also look at sustainability. So here's an example, I think, where you have major effort and endeavor using modeling, using data to kind of project what it would look like and then to set a blueprint or a plan. So in this case, they don't set policy, but you can see how the modeling has influenced and the economics has influenced policy. I took a look at the Global Fund, and arguably I'm not as familiar with their work, but this is coming off the website. And you can see that they're starting to predict what the impact would be. I circled treatment there because they said that treatment wouldn't have much of an impact, I guess, a little bit of a half moon, and that bothered me a little bit, so I thought I'd highlight it. But I think it'll have more impact, but we'll see. And then they use the investment frameworks there to actually look at the impact, and they show significant impact from scaling up treatment. So they're looking at these things. I would say that this is actually, they're going to have a new generation of models that actually focus on the country, and then we should watch that space as well. So this is going to be very exciting, and they will use modeling and projections to move forward. So now we go back to when to start varies by country, and I just want to remind us that some countries are actually a little bit ahead of where we are. Now, actually, WHO recommends treatment for everybody less than 500, plus a series of basically test and treat categories, which include TB patients, children less than 5, serodiscordant couples, hepatitis B, et cetera. So many people, or most people, will be eligible under the new WHO guidelines. But where most countries here, the focus here is that most countries are at less than 350 still. But one size doesn't fit all. So we heard the Malawi story. Basically, from the 2010 guidelines, they said, no, we want to do option B+. And now, if you look at that map, many countries in Africa are going in that direction. And Malawi saw a 700% increase in the number of pregnant women that got on treatment. So it looks like it's working well for Malawi. I also am just back from Rwanda, and Rwanda's looking at the WHO guidelines saying, geez, I was there with WHO and UNAIDS, and they said, you went pretty far, but we actually think we want to go a little bit farther. We want to try test and treat with sex workers and men who have sex with men. And actually, they got the community there to ask for that as well. The community was there and said, we want that as well. And they've done the modeling and the math, and they think that it wouldn't cost that much, and it would have an added benefit. So I think you're going to see this from a number of countries where they actually take the modeling and data and make these sorts of conclusions. So, however beautiful the strategy is, you should occasionally look at the results. Winston Churchill, my favorite civil servant. And in Vancouver, we saw, and it's a little bit blurry, but you see that this is political leadership there, and they have taken a look at the results, and they have taken a look at the strategy, and they are fully backing TAFs. And when I say TAFs, I mean expanding treatment to prevent illness, death, and transmission. Here are the HIV incidence trends by countries, and in the red, this is the decrease, and in the red, that's not so good, and we're watching that incidence very, very carefully and looking at our strategy. Now the transition is from does it work to really how do we expand it, and I think we're going to hear a lot more about that. Now, finally, I'll get to the ODA loop. Now, this, many of you might be familiar with this, but this is developed by an American fighter pilot, I guess, back in the 70s or 80s, I'd say. The idea is that you observe, orient, decide, act. Well, when you're flying a fighter jet, you need to actually be able to do that pretty quickly. I would make the argument that if you look at the HIV modeling and if you look at the policy and if you look at the allocation of resources, we are way too slow. Okay, so we observe, we kind of orient, we decide, we maybe act, maybe we go backwards, et cetera. I really would urge us that we have to go much more quickly than we are going now. And this is the deadly retrospectoscope. Now, this is some work by Brian Williams, my favorite modeler, who basically took a look at South Africa and said, what about test and treat? And you saw a taste of that in the last panel. Here he shows basically that, you know, if we would have started in 95, which is, of course, completely unreasonable, that wouldn't have happened, then we could have prevented much of the incidents and much of the deaths and much of the badness that's there. Now, the reason I show this is that, you know, if we continue to kind of go along the business as usual, these sorts of modelers are not these sorts, but modelers will come along and they will model the effects of our indecision and or our lack of action. And I remind us all of the climate change models in the beginning. So in conclusion, really, hopefully I wasn't too long, but we believe models are useful, but they're not sufficient to change policy. You need science. Science catches up, and I didn't talk about the science in this talk, but it catches up. You need politics and finance and leadership in order to make these changes. Clearly, we need better data. We need clarity when framing the questions. When we did the Lancet paper, we included prevention in our modeling, which prevention interventions and these sorts of things need to be clear. Our feedback loop is way too slow. We can't every year take a look at the results. It needs to be more on the Malawi model every quarter. How are we doing? Are we expanding treatment? How's testing going? And then we have to accelerate the policymaking and the implementation and not forget about it is really about providing services for people living in countries. So, and the last thing for Herman Biggs is basically, I believe public health is purchasable. I agree with him. It's within a few natural and important limitations, any community can determine its own health. And I'd like to just thank my co-collaborators, although they didn't have a chance to look at the talk. They just helped me with a lot of the ideas.
Thank you, Dr. Granish, for having pared down your presentation. We were somewhat preoccupied yesterday, but amount of slides you had, but it's good you've been able to keep it on time. We'll now have a comment by Dr. Carlos Cáceres from the Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia.
Thank you very much, Celso. Robin's presentation this afternoon has been elegant and broad. It has presented substantial epidemiological information as well as the result of modeling exercises. So I will perhaps try to focus on some of the tensions it points out. Obviously, ARV-based prevention of sexual transmission, mainly the preventive effects of treatment and PrEP, represents now a key component of combination prevention. And the field we know we're seeing is changing quickly. You know, what was early treatment for prevention until a few months ago, now it's considered treatment. Decisions must be made about priorities in prevention and care, and certainly modeling can help. We should just remember that modeling is a fantastic tool as long as our hypotheses and parameters are sound. Evidence to develop our models is more necessary than ever, but it must come from several fields and consider scenarios with diverse levels of success. Global collaboration to supply such evidence is needed. Modeling in the HIV field has been used for a long time. Interestingly, it has been very useful in retrospective evaluations, and there we have checked whether observed patterns are consistent with a specific hypothesis. For example, whether or not there has been impact in the fight against HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. And their model parameters are better known. With regard to the future, modeling is always less straightforward because parameters are less certain. And definitely, One example is what we project and observed about the uptake of, for example, voluntary male medical circumcision. Models must consider barriers and less than ideal scenarios and parameters as well. Another thing to point out is that modeling is or what we are discussing about treatment as prevention is a changing concept. It's a moving target. Moreover, the word, the expression is used with different meanings. In some cases, we're talking about, or at least until a few months ago, treatment before between 350 and 500 C4 cells. In other cases, now we are referring to treatment over 500 cells. And even more so, in some cases, we're talking about the prevention effects of any treatment, any ARV treatment, or even the use of ARVs for prevention, including PrEP, for example. So when we talk about this, we have to be really clear about what we're discussing, because obviously implications for each of the definitions are different. In terms of barriers that models should account for, we should, for example, to assess the impact of treatment on prevention, we have new guidelines, WHO guidelines, but countries need to adopt those guidelines, and they will do it at different paces. We have to deal with low testing rates, considerable gaps in ARV coverage, particularly among key populations, health systems and community preparedness, financial costs, I mean, the fact that these will be increased, partner notification issues for prioritization, structural components that have often and will keep neglected to some extent, because in part we understand them only in a limited fashion. And then the fact that effectiveness is not guaranteed unless targeting, quality, and coverage are adequate. To also talk about PrEP and barriers for PrEP, there's still a long way to go with PrEP. Health systems limitations need to be addressed, particularly cost and potential competition with treatment, the capacity to increase testing and monitor use, and acceptability issues, which are also substantial, both among beneficiaries, among providers, and among decision makers. Just to end, I will mention an effort that is under the auspices of WHO being started to promote dialogue between or among people around the world interested in policy, social science, cost effectiveness, modeling, and or demonstration projects around ARV-based prevention. It's a network for multidisciplinary studies in ARV-based prevention, or NEMUS. And the idea with this network that is just being formed is to discuss opportunities and challenges for implementation of ARV-based prevention, to foster collaboration in ongoing studies, develop concepts and resources for collaboration in the design and implementation of potentially useful studies, and to communicate findings and lessons learned for global stakeholders. No? And their questions, potential research questions, might focus on policy, for example, who are the stakeholders, are they aware, what are their perspectives, health systems and cost or cost effectiveness, are services prepared to offer ARV-based prevention, what needs to be implemented and what's the cost, etc. Social science, how will people react to introduction of new strategies, is it likely that they will be transformed by users, and bioethics. Who and how should decide the inclusion of each of these measures if universal access to treatment has not been reached yet? I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlos. We'll move on to Dr. James Kahn from the University of California, San Francisco.
Thank you. We've had a great overview of the incredible potential extremely important gains, and I'd like to focus a little bit on issues, practical issues that we face going forward. In particular, I think our goal, if we're going to do ART to control HRV, to control HIV is to, first of all, achieve scale at each step in the necessary cascade. That's HIV identification, the delivery of ART, and, of course, the reduction of incidence. And to do so with efficiency and synergy with other diseases. Let me start with scale. How do we reach enough people with testing so that people know they're infected? Certainly voluntary testing and routine testing in healthcare settings. But I'd like to propose there is a major role for community testing, both household-based and community campaigns. We certainly have evidence that 80 to 90% coverage is available very quickly with these kinds of methods at a low cost of about $10 per person tested. So this seems to be a critical strategy to achieve testing coverage. You can't see because I'm looking at my slides and you aren't, but we've developed a method, some of our work at UCSF, to specify the mix of testing strategies by population. And that seems to be a critical issue to decide as testing is planned. In terms of achieving ART, it's necessary to refer from testing and to have those referrals arrive with a high likelihood to initiate care. And now there is a broad discussion of same-day ART initiation. We have one study ongoing called STARTS, which is testing the operational implications of same-day testing, including CD4 testing if required by national policy. We also then need to retain individuals in care, including individuals with high CD4 counts who aren't sick. And initial indications from our early study is that people can be retained in care with viral load suppressed. But there will be barriers to remaining in care. Examples include transport problems. And we have found with work from my colleagues at UCSF, things like embarrassment at missing appointments. Once an appointment is missed, the person doesn't want to come in and admit they missed an appointment. These are issues that need to be documented and addressed. The third step is, of course, achieving the anticipated reductions in HIV incidence. We need to verify data from research studies and the predictions from modeling that we can achieve both viral load suppression and a drop in HIV incidence. The evidence so far is certainly encouraging, but more research of programs done at scale is critically important. I know of four community trials underway in sub-Saharan Africa, including the SEARCH study being done at UCSF, which I and another panelist are involved in, and three other studies. Of course, national surveillance will also help document this and has already shown indications of progress in PEPFAR countries with lots of ART delivery. Two more points, efficiency and synergy. Efficiency, by that I mean achieving these services at the lowest reasonable cost. This will encourage sustainability, which is going to be a huge issue unless the funding situation completely changes, and also to facilitate an easier fit with other health priorities and other spending priorities in general. There is a challenge here. As we distribute care more widely geographically, clinics will have smaller HIV patient loads, and this can lead to some potential inefficiencies. Ways to address this include task shifting, which is now widely accepted, integration with other clinical services, a targeted role for physicians so that they can supervise and deal with complex cases without committing too much of their relatively expensive time to this. Favorable configuration of salaries and the workday, the clinic day, which have created some challenges. And finally, efficient and effective methods to retain individuals in care. My last topic is synergy with other diseases. We've talked for many years about using HIV as an agent of broad improvement in healthcare, not as a diversion of existing system capacity away from other diseases. And it's now clear that there are ways to accomplish that. There are biological synergies. For example, preventing malaria with bed nets reduces the rate of decline of CD4, as we know from a couple of different studies. There are also synergies available with the delivery of prevention. We can get efficient, high coverage of HIV testing combined with other interventions, such as bed nets to prevent malaria, diarrhea to, filters to prevent diarrhea. And also, we can screen for non-communicable diseases like hypertension and diabetes. This is a critical next phase. The anticipated direction of epidemiology in the developing world is a much better control of infectious diseases and reproductive health problems, and therefore a shift to the growing problem of NCDs. And finally, in the delivery of care, we can use quality improvements that we've seen in HIV and extend them to the NCDs with improved monitoring and availability of medications. Also with improving health system capacity, logistics, IT use, and clinical protocols, all are areas where we've made great progress in HIV, and those would allow huge benefits if extended more broadly within the health system. Thank you.
We'll now have Dr. Viviane Dias Lima, formerly from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, nowadays from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Oh, hi. So basically, my approach, like in this panel, will be like when I read papers about modeling, which kind of questions come to my mind, and then the other question that I ask, like, okay, we have this amount of evidence, so what do we need, you know, to implement whatever that we feel that is cost-effective, that has been shown to be, you know, to work in the field? So basically, we have seen lots of models based on the heterosexual epidemic in Africa, and there was a paper recently that asked the question, so how does it work when we are talking about not the heterosexual epidemic, but now the MSM epidemic? How all that we have learned in the heterosexual, how can we translate that to the other epidemics that we don't see that much modeling going on? And so the question is, like, can we expect the same benefits that we observed in the heterosexual epidemic to be, you know, translated directly into the MSM epidemic, for example? The other question is, like, most models that have shown that TASP, I'm using TASP here, there are so many terms, decreased HIV, new infections, and mortality case. But there was a meeting, the HIV consortium modeling, showing that, you know, there are so many models and there are lots of heterogeneity in the results from these models. So if you, you know, look at all these models together, so which one should I go with, you know what I mean? So, and the difference sometimes comes because some models, they really highlight the importance of acute infection, and then other ones, they really make sure they compare the short and the long-term impacts, which kind of assumptions we are making in each of those scenarios. So basically, how do we move forward? You know what I mean? Like, how can we modelers better inform policymakers? How can we incorporate empirical data into our models? Because maybe that's the way that we can make sure that the models are more homogeneous when we are trying to inform policymakers. And then so, Ruben has shown that some models have highlighted that, oh, if I increase, let's say, number of people on treatment, so maybe risk behavior, adherence, or even drug resistance can, you know, can jeopardize the impact of TASP. But the question is, are these still issues that, you know, we have to be discussing here? Like, we have shown in several programs that maybe adherence or even resistance is not really an issue. So can we move forward from that? And we have multiple prevention strategies like PrEP, TASP, test and treat, male circumcision, you know, and the list goes on and on and on. So then how to optimize the implementation of these strategies? How can we prioritize the delivery of these strategies? And there was a researcher who shown the cascade of care. We see lots of attrition in the cascade of care every time we move to the other step. Maybe we should talk about retention, you know what I mean? Because we can put test everybody, we can try to put everybody on treatment, but can we keep them on treatment? And also we should make sure that when we are playing with models and that we are looking at interventions that always is going to keep these individuals, once they were tested, you know, linked to the healthcare system, so we don't see them when the CD4 is really low, and then, you know, we don't have as many options as a person that has a CD4 of 500. So basically, these are issues that always in my mind when I'm reading the modeling literature, when I'm trying to, you know, to write a model. So basically, I believe, at least in my center, we have epidemiologists, we have MDs, we have a health economist, we have lots of people working together. So I think it's important to engage researchers of different disciplines to strengthen our models. And one thing that I always think is important, we need to be transparent when we are reporting our results so you know where we are coming from. And then the models, they should acknowledge their uncertainties. So where are we lacking data, which kind of assumptions we made to overcome the lack of data, which parameters in our model are most sensitive to the assumptions that we make, and maybe we should, with that, we should help to prioritize data collection to strengthen our models.
Thank you, Viviania. Now we'll have Dr. Jorge Saavedra from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Ciudad de Mexico.
Thank you. Last night I was looking at the slides, and Ruben sent us 106 slides, so I think he shrinked like half of them. So a lot of my comments are related to those 106, but I will try to shorten it to the ones shown here. So as Ruben said, we know it works. So his question was how to expand them and be move how to expand it. So I think the question now is how we rapidly expand treatment. It's not just about expanding, how to do it rapidly. I think that the new guidelines, the new WHO guidelines, they need to be more prescriptive to countries and less open to the willingness of countries to adopt them or not. Still, most countries of the world still debating, including my country, Mexico, if it is possible and convenient for them to move from 350 to 500. In every single country, politicians and policymakers like to highlight how special, how unique, and how different their countries and their populations are compared to the rest of the world. But sometimes I think for myself, or sometimes I ask them openly, so you think your country is populated by Martians? And that's why it's so different from the rest of the world? Of course, clearly not. They are more likely to be equal to some others. Last June, I had the opportunity to meet with President Vladimir Putin of Russia, to tell him how important it was for the Global Fund, the contributions coming from Russia, and why he's in his role of chair of the G20 should invite the other G20 emerging economies to contribute as well. So his answer, as expected, was to first let me know why Russia is different from the rest of the world. But surprisingly for me, he agreed that Russia is doing really bad internally in terms of controlling its HIV epidemic. So, and this is really clear when you see the numbers from Russia, when you see the numbers of people living with HIV, regardless of their CD4 cell counts, and then the numbers receiving ART is less than 10%. That means that if you are HIV positive in Russia, you are probably better off if you ask for asylum in Uganda or in Haiti, because chances to get ART in those two countries are much higher than if you remain in Russia. So those are kind of surprising things that, of course, politicians don't like to hear. But yes, politics are playing a role on creating obstacles on not to advance to an effective control of a global of the global epidemic. I think that if international air traffic control was managed in the way we currently manage public health, I'm sure we will be having plane crashes every 15 minutes. So that's why we need like a public health convention or at least HIV control convention in order for all of us to agree that it is possible to control the HIV epidemic and just see on the same direction. It is very common also to hear about the difficulty to reach minority populations severely affected by HIV in countries with concentrated epidemics. There are people difficult to find, people difficult to link into care, people difficult to retain. And then when we finally make them sit in front of the HIV doctor, they are not offered treatment because they are not below 350. And that's probably the smartest way to lose them again. So I really believe that countries with concentrated epidemics should be the first ones to move from to 500 to start ART. So better to say that the first one to move to treatment for all, regardless of CD4 cell counts, should be these countries first. There are some popular concepts that sounds good and everybody applauds, like country ownership and shared responsibility. But if you look behind those concepts, country ownerships can drive to endless discussions inside the countries and take years to arrive to the right conclusions or to the same conclusions. And thousands of new infections and deaths later, they will agree. Until the local politicians and policymakers feel that, okay, we own the concept and we can move forward. The concept of shared responsibility is, in other words, of rich countries saying we are not willing to increase our aid to poorer countries, so you better start paying yourselves. And that's shared responsibility. Let's assume that all low and even middle-income countries of the world had perfect, equal distribution of their wealth, of their GDP. This will mean that every low-income countries will, people, person in every low-income country will receive $1,000 per year, and on the middle-income countries, low-middle-income countries, they will receive $4,000 per year. Can you imagine a person in the UK or in the US trying to live with $1,000 or $4,000 a year, they will be immediately considered on extreme poverty and subject of aid, not subject to shared responsibility programs to obligate them to pay their fair share. Another key aspect about rapid expansion will be, let's forget about another very popular term, BCT. And move faster to BCT, or to BTC, I mean, not voluntary counseling and testing, but to voluntary testing and then counseling if you are HIV positive. I think that's a rapid way to approach to this goal. And as we move forward down the cascade of treatment, we also need to focus then on controlling the viral load. When I saw the numbers of the UK on the previous presentation, so for me, it was clear that that they were expanding ART, but not necessarily they were lowering their national HIV viral load. But how can they measure and lower the national viral load if there is not such a measure? So, but it is clear that if you are still have a high national viral load, that the chances of people getting infected are much bigger. And finally, I will talk about the prices of ARVs, mainly for upper middle income countries that are subject to free trade agreements. And I will use the example of Mexico because Ruben showed that a slide there where you can see clearly that Mexico is spending more than Brazil. And if you see the epidemic in Mexico is less than half the size of Brazil epidemic, and how can we be spending more than Brazil? And we have South Africa has 30 times more larger epidemic than Mexico, and Mexico is spending like one third of what South Africa is spending. So prices here, they are playing a major role, and they will keep on playing a major role, mainly after more and more countries join of these free trade agreements, and there is a danger there. So even when we in science, and science has the solution, so politics and economics have a lot of barriers in order for us to achieve those kinds of goals. Thank you.
Maybe Brazil hasn't been spending enough or wisely. We'll now come to Dr. Harsham Mathur Murphy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the United States.
Thank you, and thanks. I'd like to start by just thanking Ruben for what I thought was a great presentation summarizing modeling and costing work. I wanted to maybe focus on two themes in particular in response to your presentation. So first, thanks for that grand title of third generation economics. I like to think that that's kind of what I'm doing is third generation. It's I think an important point to keep in mind, particularly in light of the comment we got from the Minister of Health in Malawi. It's essential not just I think to show some of the gains in terms of life years saved with this much money that we've invested, but also to be mindful of the fact that there may be some very large economic returns. And I think this is a distinction as an economist that I often make between cost-effectiveness analyses and cost-benefit analyses. And one of the things that we're trying to do in some work Jim Kahn and I are doing is ideally to combine both the best of cost-effectiveness analyses, which shows how many life years can be saved with this many millions of dollars being spent, but also to show if you add up the economic gains in terms of higher labor productivity, but also the kinds of impacts we've seen in Kenya and other settings where it's not just that people work more when they initiate ART, but also there are some secondary benefits to the households of the patients. So you can imagine in a resource-limited setting where more employment and more income for an adult with HIV may also have significant implications for children in those households. So we've seen some evidence of higher rates of school enrollment following the initiation of ART, for adults, mind you. And that's a kind of long-term impact of an investment that we make today that I think ministries of finance and ministers of health should be aware of. And I think there is that potential for treatment as prevention and other strategies that advocate for early ART initiation to maybe generate those kinds of economic benefits. So it would be nice down the road to put together a nice number that says this is the cost of spending, of investing in ART initiation for however many millions of people have HIV right away. But then this is also the benefit in terms of the added employment gains, education gains, et cetera. So that's something we're going to try to do in the SEARCH study that Jim mentioned, which is a recently initiated trial of ART initiation at irrespective of CD4 counts. But I think also other programs that are doing this should be monitoring such indicators. The second theme, and this is sort of the other major comment I wanted to make, is as an economist who sort of has been trained in the study of individual decision-making and behavior, one of the aspects of models that I'm most skeptical of is the assumptions that are made about behavioral parameters. So we may know something about the prevention effectiveness of early ART, but we are at the moment making some assumptions on the behavioral aspects, and many of the panelists have already mentioned this, and I think it's going to come up again during the conference. But I do want to make a point about what I see as a potential role for economics or the behavioral sciences more generally to inform these models and perhaps to show ways in which we can not just accept the sort of cost effectiveness that's been modeled so far, but perhaps enhance the cost effectiveness even if we find better ways of lower cost ways of doing things. And in economics, there's been a growing body of work that focuses on combining the models that economists have developed with models from psychology to show how some behavioral economic factors can improve behaviors. We've seen some work being done on adherence to ART, some work that's been done to show how behavioral economic interventions such as incentives can be used to keep people in care. I think just the fact that even in Vancouver there was a reference to the fact that some small costs of coming to the clinic or small costs of getting drugs can make a big difference is a reference to the fact that economic parameters can make a big difference here. So I think that's another aspect of the models that I think we should be paying more attention to. Just what are the behavioral parameters that we really need to zero in on, whether it's regular testing or adherence, and what are then the interventions that we can bring to bear to improve those? Stop with that.
Last comment will come from Professor Alan Whiteside from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa.
So the last discussant in the last session on a Sunday afternoon. What can I say that's going to be interesting and make it worth your while staying on for another few minutes? Modeling and economics are really important. In South Africa, we wouldn't have had the change in 1990 if it hadn't been for some really foresighted modeling and scenario building which showed the choices that we were facing. So I absolutely believe in this. But I do think it's important to understand that if it's not cost effective, then you can't make a case for doing it. And I think that this is where one of the major problems lies. And that is that we are, in this room, the choir, and we're preaching to each other. And I think it's about time that we recognized that we are the choir and we believe in what we're saying, but we're talking to each other. So I think we should be putting as many people on treatment as possible because it's the right thing to do. But I think we've forgotten that we need to make a case for treatment outside this room. And it's not that simple. The minister this morning talked about the taxpayers who would continue to provide revenue to the Malawian Revenue Service if they were on treatment. I'm not going to presume to talk for Malawi, but I can talk for Swaziland or for South Africa, since I know those countries intimately. In Swaziland, 40% of adults are unemployed, and many of them have given up even looking for jobs. They're engaged in subsistence agriculture. They don't get involved in paying taxes. Should they be denied treatment? So we have to do what Harsha was saying and start looking for other reasons why we should be providing treatment. And I think we need to start making a policy, an economic and a political case for treatment, which we are not doing convincingly. We also need to think about who we need to be talking to, because it's not just the medical people and the scientists. It's actually not the people in this room. It's the ministers of finance. And we also need to understand that we're operating in a competitive environment. You may or may not be aware that the Global Fund is going for replenishment, and they're hoping that they'll get 15 billion, although the jury's out on that. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But when that money comes in, it's going to have to be divided between four competing interests, and they are competing. And I've been in meetings where the competition has been fierce and bloody. It's competition between AIDS. There's an AIDS interest group. It's competition with TB. There's a TB interest group. And malaria, and now health systems. How are we going to make the case that what we want is the right thing to do? I think the exceptionality of AIDS is over. I think we need to be smarter with our advocacy. And I want to finish off with a little pick up on what Ruben said, and also one of our colleagues here talked about plane crashes. Because when I look around this room, I think we've got a few things in common. We all care deeply about HIV and AIDS and bringing an end to this epidemic. But I think one of the commonalities, and maybe we can just do a straw poll on this, is there anyone in this room who hasn't been on a plane, who hasn't been on a plane in the last month? Put up your hand if you haven't been on a plane in the last month. Oh, there are a few people. You're environmentally correct. Thank you. You're keeping that graph of global emissions down. Thank you for that. The rest of us, we're irresponsible. And we're going to, well, I would say burn in hell, but the way the global temperatures are going, we might just burn on Earth. So when you're on a plane, you all know that sensation of you're coming into land, and I hope this hasn't been the experience of many of you, but some of you will have had the experience, and you're coming in and you can see the lights and you can see the runway, and suddenly the pilot puts on the power and off you go again. That, in flying terms, is called a go-round. The pilot has made a decision that he can't land, that if he does, there's going to be it's going to be an unfortunate episode. It's a go-round. And he's on the tower, and he's saying, Norwich Tower, this is KLB 256. We have a go-round. And he goes around, and he comes down again. Why am I telling you this? Because what Ruben talked about as OODA is actually so very, very important. That we need to, Ruben, give us those terms, orientate?
Observe, orient, decide, act.
We need to observe, orientate, decide, act. It's the decisions that fighter pilots are making. It's the decision that every commercial pilot that's flying you around the world is making all the time. And I think that what Julio said this morning is correct. We have observed, we have orientated. I don't think we're doing the last two. I don't think we're deciding, and I don't think we're acting enough. And one of the reasons why we're failing to do that is we're exceptionally poor advocates of our cause because we do not understand the environment that we're operating in. So thank you very much.
Thank you all. I think we have 5 minutes left. I mean, we're past our time, but 5 minutes for 1 hour.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Merman. I'm from the CDC in the U.S. Thank you for very broad-reaching and interesting presentations. I had a question. Good modeling can be both accurate and impactful. Do you have an example where anyone at the podium has actually presented a model to policymakers and they've stopped doing something because of it?
Has to be stopped, can't be started.
Exactly.
Stop.
Okay.
Let us think about it for a little while.
Carlos.
You know, that was an excellent overview and presentations and discussion. I think that what ends up happening frequently is people, and particularly I think many politicians, grow very skeptical of modeling. And I'm not sure modeling is necessary. I mean, I was interested in hearing South Africa modeling made a big difference. Took a lot of time to make a big difference. I mean, you know, I think the barriers were not the model. The barriers were others. Let's be very clear about why South Africa didn't start antiretroviral therapy. I don't think it was lack of models. It was lack of leadership. So how do we use models in a way that, quite frankly, allows people not to continue? I hear a lot of people are very skeptical about models. And how do we balance the models with the reality in such a way that we can actually make a difference?
I mean, thank you. I'll just touch maybe on what Alan mentioned last about advocacy. Two centers, Tororo and Bali in Uganda, were involved in PrEP, and we've been working to roll out PrEP at our 11 TASO centers, and then we got this directive, you can't roll out PrEP. And yesterday I just walked out of the AGM into the plane, Alan, for the first time in the last 1 month, and I had to stay and have the minister listen to a client telling him that we can't continue just waiting for the guidelines and the policies. We had to stage it and get the Minister of Health there at the annual general meeting, have a client read out to him what their appeal is. And I, the executive director, wasn't the right person to make that appeal. We had to get the clients to talk for themselves, get the board chair to say, you know, we can't go on like this. And I want to agree with you and underscore the fact that the advocacy has to happen at the highest level. Michelle was last week in Uganda talking with the president to say that we do have to change these things around. And I just want to underscore that point. Thank you.
Maybe I'll take a stab at actually Jono and Carlos's question. Jono, I had a chance to think about it. I can't think of anything that's actually been modeled to make things stop. But that's normally because I think when people model, they model in a positive frame. So it's pretty rare to do the negative side. If you do this, then you're going to have that consequence. If you do that, this is going to be the consequence. Although that can easily be done, but it requires people to be asked to do it. And a lot of times the people that are making decisions don't have the kind of courage to go look in the negative frame. And then in terms of framing, I do think modeling does help with framing, because if you look at what in the presentation I made, and I went very, very quickly, the framing quickly shift. It was actually a framing that looked at less than 350 for a long time, and then all of a sudden the framing shifted to, oh, let's look at 500, and now the framing that we're all discussing is what would it be like to test and treat everybody. That doesn't mean that we have to do that, but for people that are looking at the science and the people that are designing the research studies and the people that are doing this, the policy, now their frame is a little bit different. Oh, we should be considering this. And you see what Rwanda did with the modeling. They considered a frame that was testing and treating everybody. Now, they may not decide to go there, but that's the frame. And then one last final bite of the cherry here is that in terms of your OODA, in terms of your pilot flying that plane, your modeling is just another instrument there. It's basically, it's puttering away in the background. Now, before we had the consortium, we had a whole bunch of models just, and for better or for worse, we had a lot of models that are puttering away here, and hopefully they're using data and just churning like this. And then you're getting the epi data as well, and then you're getting the political and the financial, et cetera, and that's how you're basically landing the plane. But models are essential. They're telling you where we might be in 500 meters or 5,000 meters, and where we're going to be and what actually we need to be thinking about. And they need to be corrected. If they just are, if they're static, then you're in trouble. But short answer.
Well, thank you very much. I'll thank the panelists and close the session. Thank you.
What's that?
I'm still thinking.
No.
You know, I mean, I think I can think of a few examples that maybe help something happen, but no, I don't think anything stopped.